Hello, and thank you for listening to the new series, Series 2 of the Nurse Researcher Podcast. This series aims to chat to clinical academics and to really identify what their role entails, how the jobs are split, what they do in their daily life, and really what are the tips and what advice can they give to people aspiring to be a clinical academic. So give us a listen, share the podcast with others, press follow wherever you listen to or get your podcasts, and we hope you enjoy the episodes. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Nurse Researcher Podcast, our Series 2, our clinical academic series, and we have a bit of a bonus episode for you today. So a fellow podcaster and nurse, so I want to say hello to Dr. Roslyn Austin from Stavanger University in Norway. She's a postdoctoral researcher and podcaster. Good to have you with us, Roslyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Andrew. I'm very excited to be here. It's kind of fun to be the guest instead of the interviewer.
Yeah, the pressure's off, isn't it? It's easy when you've just got to talk about yourself rather than thinking about what to ask and what to think, isn't it? It's much harder when you're this side of things. So I've got somebody with me who can empathize a little bit today.
Definitely. I'm so glad that we found each other, though, because we're having so many fun conversations about how to be a podcaster. But that's by the by.
Absolutely. So this is not about me. It's not about my podcast. It's about you. So I'm going to take you right back, the question that we always ask everybody. How and when and where did you become a nurse?
Well, so my story is a bit weird because I came to nursing after I fell in love with research. So I am addicted to education, for lack of a better way to say it. After I finished my Bachelor of Science in Kinesiology, which is sort of like sports medicine here in the UK, because I was educated in Canada primarily, I went on and did a master's of research in rehabilitation science and in neuroscience. And that specialized in spinal cord injury and using technology to try and help with hand function. And it was there that my passion for research really got ignited. And at the end of that master's program, I felt like the kind of research I wanted to do, as much as I enjoyed that, further away from like an acute incident, I felt like I wanted to be more involved in the acute, closer to the accident or the health crisis or whatever. And so I then applied to do nursing. So I completed my Bachelor of Nursing at the University of Calgary in what they called the BNAT program. So it's a full Bachelor of Nursing degree. So technically 4 years of a university education in Canada, which is required for nursing there. But instead of doing it in 4 years, we did it in two. And then after I finished that, I then, for personal reasons, ended up in the UK and then started working towards creating a way to have research more in my nursing career. So in the UK, that then translated into me becoming a research nurse. And I did that at Guy's and St. Thomas's. And that just that took my passion for research and like lit my world on fire, because I got to see, and I was really fortunate because in addition to working on commercial studies, I worked very closely with a consultant who was doing investigator-led studies in biomarkers and kidney research. And it showed me not just around like those skills around research delivery that you get in commercial studies, but it also showed me about being a PI, being a chief investigator, what that involved, how to set up studies in different places and things like that. So that really, really helped. And then at that point, both my husband and I were spending about 3 hours a day commuting to our places of work. Yay, working in London. And we decided to move down to the south coast of the UK, so down Portsmouth way, and both try and get jobs that were a lot closer to home. And that's where I ended up getting my job at the Portsmouth Hospitals Trust, which is now the Portsmouth University Hospital Trust, as a research nurse in cardiology. And because of sort of like my already existing master's degree, my fueled passion and understanding around what research looked like, especially in the UK and the possibilities around becoming a nurse researcher in the UK, when I went for my interview for that job, I said to everybody who was on the panel, I'm like, I want to do my PhD. So I laid the line down from the beginning. And after about a year and a half, give or take, I don't know, it gets a bit blurry. I actually was supported with one of the people who was on the interview panel, who continues to support me, Professor Paul Kalra, and Greta Westwood, who at the time was based at the Portsmouth Hospital. And together they helped me get what now everybody calls the ARC internships. And I used my ARC internship to actually write my PhD proposal, which then Paul and Greta, together with the top people in the research department at the hospital, as well as the university, they created what was then called a Clark Fellowship. And now it's somewhere between a charity-funded PhD fellowship in the UK and an NIHR. So I was sort of tied to NIHR, but not full gold NIHR funding. So it was this really unique blend that me and a few other people at Portsmouth did get the opportunity to do. So yeah, then I started my PhD, supervised by Professor Carl May.
I'm going to intervene. There's too much
Yeah.
to ask you at this stage. There's too because it's a whirlwind at the minute of everything that you've done. But we can't get over some of that, I don't think. I think some of the
Okay.
there's a really important message here. So picking up the really first UK role was a research nurse. I mean, this is a good message for the podcast. I think there's a lot of people in the UK in nursing that think the research nurse role has probably got its limitations. So they will think, right, okay, this is about study consent, this is about recruitment, retention, this is about working on somebody else's product or proposal or research. They'll see a ceiling of opportunity where actually you can hit it quite quickly. So it's probably only going to take you so far up the bands. It will learn you a great deal about everything from ethics to governance and all of the aspects of research that you want to learn about. So you've gone nursing, research nurse, and then at the point where you've gone for an interview as a research nurse, you said, but I want to do a PhD. So why did that not lose you the job? Because they'd be thinking, I don't want you to do a PhD, I want you to be a research nurse.
Well, I don't feel that I can answer that question. I think that'd be a question for the people who interviewed me. I think for me, you're 100% right. So within the UK, this role of a research nurse, and how it's funded and how it works within the overall structure of research, I'm learning is fairly unique to the UK. And conventionally, yes, most managers would not, and the structure, not even managers, let's not blame the managers, the structure wouldn't support a research nurse developing into a nurse researcher. The system, the computer says no. They want you to do exactly as you described, focus on recruitment, delivery, follow-up, data entry, yada, yada. But I think the reality is, and the more conversations I have, both because of my own podcast, but just in general to other people who are now weirdly starting to look up to me as a mentor, I think the UK is really missing a trick. And I'm not saying that every research nurse would be a great nurse researcher, but I think there are certain skill sets that would really help and inspire people to become a researcher. And like, loads and loads of people who I've talked to who are now either nurse researchers or AHP researchers or fill in the blank researcher as a non-medic clinician will all talk about how their involvement in research delivery inspired them to do a PhD.
And did the sort, so you're in a position really where you'd got people that were able to, you got visionary people around you a little bit actually that were going to support you to get funding. Do you think
Yes.
the funding is the way out of the research nurse role? And I'm not playing that role down because that sounds terrible, the way out of it. But if you want to do a PhD, it's not your first route, isn't that role, is it? Your first route is to do other things to sort of push onto a PhD because people feel like, you know, if you are a PI or a chief investigator and you've got a team, you don't want people leaving the team. You want them to be in your team. So you don't bring them on to then and train them for them to then run off to be to do a PhD. But is funding what matters, bringing that in and having that ARC funding or the Clark funding as it may have been at the time?
Well, I think to be honest, it's not just research nurses where funding is the quote unquote way out. I think that's true for multiple different types of nursing specialities. But I think funding isn't the only answer because even if you get your PhD funded, then what? And whether that's as a research nurse, whether that's as a specialist nurse, whether that's as fill in the blank nurse or a midwife, what then? What is your exit strategy? And the NIHR is starting to build into a lot of their applications much more of a sustainability statement that's required. Now, that does put it on paper, but it also doesn't mean that that institution has to deliver on that promise. And we all know in the NHS, it's either service or service or service. That's the priority. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I'm saying I think that if you want to be a researcher, regardless of what specialty of nursing you're in, 100% you need the funding for your own mental well-being, as well as for an increased probability of success at completing your PhD. But I think another really important factor around that that I think most people don't really think about is actually who are those champions? Who are those people in your institution, outside of your institution, who are going to be there, not just as supervisors, but who are going to be there after your PhD is done to say, okay, how are you pushing your career? How are you utilizing this PhD? What, how is your postdoc going? And that important transition. Because we all know, well, maybe not everybody knows, but there's been multiple audits done on NIHR, so gold standard funded PhD fellowships, whether medic, non-medic, or whatnot, and the amount of fall off once you finish your PhD, where as a nurse, as well as other professions, they PhD trained nurses just magically disappear. They're not utilizing it, so.
So you're in this position. So I'll take you back to the sort of timeline. You were in this position where a number of people were given this opportunity, like you in Portsmouth, to do the PhD. So you've got probably that's your role, that's your working role to do this PhD. At the end of it,
Not right.
no,
Not quite.
okay, go on
No.
then, go on.
So my fellowship, my role in the trust at the time that I got the fellowship was, and my contract was only ever part-time. So I wasn't employed full-time. I had come into the team as maternity cover, and the individual who came back from maternity cover didn't want to come back as full-time. So I was part-time. And how we organized it is that my fellowship that I obtained, it supplemented my income. It didn't change my hospital contract. So I didn't go from being part-time to full-time. I continued working part-time for the same amount. So that was 2 days a week that I was contracted. That never changed, but just my income changed because instead of not having income for 3 days a week, I then was getting paid to do my PhD 3 days a week. But it wasn't actually integrated in my role. Now, others who had a similar sort of, for lack of a better word to describe it, unique umbrella fellowship at Portsmouth, Some of those people, it was slightly different because they had full-time positions. It just kind of depended on the individual, and it was very bespoke arrangements. But it wasn't that I gave up part of my job to do the PhD.
It was additional. I get you. Okay. So with that in mind, then where do you go at the end of it? So, you're successful. Once that PhD has come to an end, the funding for that PhD has come to an end. You've got 2 days a week at your Portsmouth Hospital role. So how did you have to go directly into a postdoctoral application? Did you have to apply for postdoctoral funding before you'd even finished the PhD? How did you keep things ticking along?
So for me, again, going back to what you said before, being a research nurse limited a lot of my opportunities. And what I ended up doing was, again, sort of because of the people who I had around me who were advocating and championing me. And what I ended up doing is I ended up initially getting a new role that again supplemented my existing role. So I kept clocking on as a research nurse at a band six level 2 days a week. But then I also, for about a year and a half of time, got an additional role at the hospital at a 8A level that was in partnership with another colleague there. And our role was to both do some investigation around what a clinical academic career could look like at Portsmouth. So a lot of stakeholder work and literature review work, as well as mentoring and supporting existing people who were in a PhD fellowship of whatever shape and format that it was at Portsmouth to increase and highlight the voice of non-medic research fellows. So I did that. So that sort of supplemented my income. And while I was doing and gave me a bit more breathing space between the completion of my PhD and what I was going to do next. And at the same time, I was looking around at opportunities. I was putting in applications at University of Portsmouth, not University of Portsmouth, University of Southampton for postdoc level jobs, as well as elsewhere in the world. I kind of like had my ear to the ground for opportunities because I was under no illusion that I would be able to magically have a consultant level job created or an advanced nurse practitioner job created for me, because that role within research nursing just doesn't exist. I think there's one in the UK, and then I think there's another one in Australia. Like they're rare as hen's teeth. And so I wasn't expecting that to happen. I mean, I was hoping, but I wasn't expecting it. So when the news came that the decision makers in the hospital were like, we can't do this, I'd already put in other applications elsewhere, and those applications had been successful. And so then I was trying to make a decision as to what I was going to do, whether or not I was going to keep my preferred research focus around cardiovascular and be a little bit risky and leave temporarily, partly anyway, the UK, or whether I was going to shift my research focus and go to the really supportive environment that was the university, that is the University of Southampton.
Okay. So how do you end up in Norway?
So I did, well, they gave me a job. That's how. That's an easy one.
And was this the main postdoctoral job?
This was a postdoctoral job,
Yeah.
and it was one of three that I had applied for. But of the three that I had applied for, it was the only one that had links to what I'd done in my PhD research. And I know that's not necessarily a requirement for a postdoc, but I have become incredibly passionate about research within heart failure. And especially research that's focused on improving the experience of patients. And I'm not talking, education. I'm talking bigger than that. I'm talking about what is causing their treatment to be burdensome And then dialing down and boiling through those factors to say, how can we change that? Even if it means looking at and trying to find ways to change something as big as our NHS.
Yeah. And
And Norway, the postdoc job in Norway at the University of Stavanger had components of heart failure as well as burden of treatment, which is sort of like my real passion areas.
are you located there? Do you work, are you working there sort of remotely? How do you do that? And how do you do research in a second language?
Yes. Oh, so there's a lot of questions there. Let's start with where I live. The best way I can describe my life, and it sounds funny to say, I live in two places. And that sounds like a really weird thing to say, but the more people I talk with, the more that I realize that that's not as unique as I thought it was. So I, the project leads and the university there, very kindly, took under consideration my situation. So the role, the job is a short-term contract. It's 2 years. And if I was going to live there full time, that would either mean I'd not see my husband for 2 years, or it would mean I'd have to relocate my husband for 2 years. Now, my husband's job is not a job that relocates easily. And so that just wasn't practical for the two of us. And so I approached them, and I think it's a hidden benefit of COVID, really. I think because of COVID and the amount of people that have realized the amount of work that you can do remotely, they entertained the idea of me working remotely. And we agreed and had it written in the contract that at minimum, I do 4 trips a year, give or take adjustments as needed. After a trial period, but that I'd not been in Norway for more than 6 weeks, and neither would I try and be away from Norway for more than 6 weeks. And when I'm remotely, like I'm on a Norwegian laptop, I regularly check in with the team. I use the same systems that they use. So I stay connected to them, even though I'm not physically there all the time. And so far, a year and a little bit in, it's working for us, I think. They seem happy with me, and I seem happy with the situation. So
And
I think it's working.
the language issue.
The language issue. So the language issue is a complication. But again, I think for me, the group that I work with in Norway is, it's not huge, but there's quite a few individuals in it. So the group has got four main professors, an emeritus professor. It has two and a third PhD who's starting, as well as some administrative support and things. So when they put this postdoc out, the thing that they wanted help with mostly was around analysis and dissemination of the results. And so with that changes what my postdoc role looks like. So a lot of postdoc roles look more like doing the data collection, so sorting out the bits and pieces around how we do how that data is collected and doing that, whether that's interviews, whether that's quantitative data. But for this project, that's not what they needed. They more wanted somebody to help with the analysis, especially focused on more the quantitative results, as well as some of the results around the engagement with the intervention that they've created. So it allowed, again, me a real benefit for having a slightly different postdoc because, again, with my research nurse experience, the thing that I wasn't missing experience in data collection. I'd done enough data collection to sink a ship even before my PhD around lots of different types of study types and things like that. But I hadn't had as much experience around the analysis and the dissemination piece thing. So it was sort of like something that worked. But the language is important, and I'm teaching myself and learning, and the university is supporting me in it, basic Norwegian, but I'm at like the level of a 2-year-old, so I can say like single words when it comes to speech. But when it comes to comprehending, I'm able to pick up the gist of a lot of things now, and that really helps. And then I've also mastered the use of AI and online tools for translation. For example, and this is such a cool thing, did you know you don't need to use Google Translate in order to translate a document or an email?
I didn't know.
Yeah, so Word, top tip for everybody out there. So Word, just ordinary MS Word, if you go into the review tab, you can translate the whole document from any language to any language in like seconds.
Oh, that could be game changer. That could be
It
game
is.
changer.
And what's interesting is that when I've done it around certain things, so like there's been a couple of things with the delivery of the randomized control trial that we're running in Norway, where the team have, and I've helped with some of the coordination stuff and a couple of like amendments and things like that all need to be in Norwegian. And I've written them in English, hit the translate button in Word, sent it to a Norwegian and said, how crazy is this? Is this way off? And they're like, actually, it's a few grammar errors, but it's not that horrible. And I'm
No.
like, wow.
Wonderful.
But yeah, top
Wonderful.
tip,
Yeah.
use
Yeah.
Word to translate.
Yeah. We'll pass that one on. So, the here and now, you host the Researcher Revealed podcast.
Yes.
How did that come about?
So it came about, I think the short version of a long and sordid tale is that the people who were in my main supervisory panel, my main supervisors for my PhD, weren't cardiovascular. I had one who was a nurse, one who was a consultant, and one who was a sociologist, and then another nurse joined in the end, but that's a story for a different day. And what that meant for me is I, for whatever reason, and maybe it was me and not knowing where to look, being a Canadian in the UK, I really struggled to find other people who were nurses within the cardiovascular sort of field who were being nurse researchers who were easy to find. And PhDs are not easy. And trying to become a nurse researcher as a nurse who's a research nurse is also not easy. And I listen to a lot of audiobooks, read a lot of books, and I listen to a lot of podcasts. And I always searched like repetitively for podcasts around research. And at the time, I could find like Andrew Huberman's big podcast from America. I found one called Academic Dames, which again was the American, but it was much more academic rather than clinician, non-medic clinicians talking about research. And I didn't find anything that was hitting that need for inspiration, that need for companionship, of feeling not so alone in this hard world. And what I ended up listening to is I listened to a lot of entrepreneurial podcasts. And the more I listened to it and the more I thought about it, the more I was like, I should do this. Because I think for me, I've been brave and fortunate enough, I'd say, that I've reached out to loads of people to talk to about their experience. And when I listen to their stories, I'm like, these need to be public. These would really help people. And so once I finished my PhD and I had a little bit of time, I was like, right, it can't be that hard, right? All you, especially I think with like in my PhD, I ended up doing a lot of recorded conversations because of COVID. And I'm like, if I can record an interview for data, why couldn't I do a podcast just using Teams? So that's kind of where it started.
Yeah, brilliant. And I've heard some episodes and
Oh,
enjoyed them.
thank you.
And I've been a guest
Yes,
At the
coming
time,
soon.
Coming soon, right? Okay, so I've been a guest on there, and that will play out at some point. So it's been nice to hear that, when you and I have been talking, that I suppose we've learned from our own guests, haven't we? And
Yeah.
I've also had people to say to me, I've worked with X for 10 years, and I've learned more about them today listening to that than I did, than I have working with them. Because people, you can be quite comfortable talking about yourself, can't you, if you're in the right environment. And I think people share things that people just wouldn't be able to drop into conversation. So it demystifies things around research, and you sense that, not in the wrong way, but if they can do it, I can do it. There's a sense of people tell you the story that they started where you were to some extent. So there's the value of that as well, isn't there? So where can people hear it? Do please
So
promote.
you can hear it and watch it because I'm a glutton for punishment. So if you search for Researcher Revealed on YouTube, it should come up as like the top one. It's green and black. You can't miss it. It's also available pretty much on every major podcasting platform. Again, if you just search for Researcher Revealed, it's hosted by Acast. So you can look there as well. If you already follow me on Twitter, then it will be, I post about that when a new episode comes live. So you can find it through there as well. It shouldn't be that hard to find.
They aren't. So do give it a listen. And
Yes, please do.
you now, what's the future hold for Rosalind Austin?
So what does the future hold? I don't know.
What's the plan at the end of this contract? Is it to stay there? What's your postdoctoral aspirations?
So my postdoctoral aspirations is to go from being a postdoc researcher to becoming a fully fledged independent nurse researcher in heart failure that has international research. That's the goal. Getting there, I think exactly, and I'd say this, I'm not saying this as a woe is me. I'm saying this more to inspire other people. It's like my journey and what you said, like it's complicated. There's a lot in there. There's levels of it that are unique. There's levels of it that were, yes, challenging, but also levels that I would never change. I don't know exactly how I'm going to get there, but I know that I've got the skills to do it, and I know that I have the people around me who are encouraging me and supporting me to do that. And so I think I'm just as excited as they are to see what that looks like and whether that's an extension of the contract in Norway, whether that's a contract somewhere else in Europe, whether that's securing an IHR advanced fellowship here in the UK. The exact how is pending, but it doesn't discourage me or stop me from taking that next step. And I think, again, that's where for me listening to podcasts has really helped is I think depending on which branch of nursing you come from, there is a little bit more of a trail for people to follow to become nurse researchers. For those who are coming from a clinical research nursing background, there isn't. It's a jungle. And that can be really scary and intimidating, but it can also be really exciting because you're going to get to be the first in so many things. And so I think that's again goes back to why I've done the podcast is I want to help people see that there isn't a highway to this career, that everybody's journey looks different and there's no such thing as a bad journey. There's just a journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Great advice and sound advice, because I think there'll be a lot of people on here, or listening, should I say, empathizing with you and sort of thinking, that's where I am. It's a different background, but that's where I am from a research perspective. So my final question then, if you had your time again from the start of your research journey, would you do anything differently, and why?
No. I don't think I'd change a single thing. Because even the things that were really hard and really horrible, they gave me a level of strength and insight that are making things that should be challenging now easy. And those challenges brought other people into my life that without them, I wouldn't be taking the steps that I am right now. I think it can sometimes be really hard when you're in the midst of a challenge. And okay, I'm going to admit it. There are times that I look at other people who've got not an easier, because I don't think there's any journey in this game that's easy, but a more established pathway, or they're like at a mecca center, for lack of a better way to say it. So they're up in Leicester, or they're at the University of Southampton, and they work in the hospital there, and they've got all the bells and all the whistles. And there's parts of me that get really green with jealousy over that. And I'll be the first to admit it. But at the same time, when I have conversations with those people and they're like, whoa, how are you doing what you're doing? I wouldn't be able to do that if I was where they were. So no,
Great,
I wouldn't change anything.
great answer. Great answer. And you're not the first to say that. You know, a lot of people sort of think that the ups and downs that they've had on the journey of what's made them what they are today. So it's a great response, and I think again people will empathize with that. So we wish you well for the future.
Thank
Do sort of feedback in, and anything that you want us to share on, on this podcast, any sort of presentations or any publications of yours, we can share that. But yeah, we wish you well. We thank you for your
Thank you.
time. Good luck with the podcast, and I'll keep
Thank
listening.
you.
I'll keep listening, and I'm sure some of these listeners will now have a listen as well. So we wish you all the best for the future. Rosalind Austin, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Bye.
Bye-bye. Hello and welcome back to this latest episode of the Nurse Researcher Podcast, where we interviewed a fellow podcaster in Dr. Rosalind Austin. Eleanor, very different career, very sort of, or very, very quick and difficult to follow at times because she's done so many different things, but what a great episode.
Yeah, no, it was really inspiring listening to Rosalind, and I thought it was such an exciting journey that she's had. I've listened to the podcast a couple of times now. I could listen again because I found it really helpful, and I think maybe it's the stage that I'm at as well in my career journey in the final year of my PhD. But I just think it was really interesting, particularly as she was a research nurse as well. And the part I think where you discussed the ceiling that comes with being a research nurse, some of the perhaps difficulties of progressing your career after that. I was curious about that a bit more. I wanted to ask more, about the culture as well. That seems to be apparent that unless you find visionaries, like she described Greta Westwood being on the interview panel for a role that she applied for to support you, and you want to do your PhD, that it could be viewed as being a negative thing if you want to apply for or do a PhD because we're needed to serve and not necessarily to develop. So I've been mulling that over. Maybe it's a bold statement I've just made, but it did make me question as well if that's the same attitude that would be seen in medicine. So I thought that was really interesting that that came up. And it's true, there are limited opportunities, I think, as a research nurse. However, if you are interested in developing a clinical academic career, the skills that you do develop as a research nurse, I think, are really unique and really set you up well to become a researcher. Even when you think of consent, informed consent, which is such a vital skill, isn't it? And depending upon the nature of the research, there's a real sensitivity, I think, that you develop as a research nurse that needs to be, for example, if you're consenting cancer patients who maybe they're newly diagnosed and discussing clinical trials with them, that's got to be handled so sensitively, hasn't it? They've just had the worst news. So I think there's so much to be gained from having a background as a research nurse and then going on to develop a clinical academic career like Roslyn. So really interesting to hear her story.
Yeah, and I think when I'm saying it was hard to follow, I don't mean the podcast as such, but what I meant was the career, really, because she's been here, there, and everywhere. I mean, it starts in Canada, then there's London, there's Stavanger, there's Portsmouth, there's all of these different things, and she's had to really work really hard to piece all of this together to make it one role, really, or one thing that she wanted to do. And probably the first person to say to us that actually research was my passion before nursing.
And although maybe I'm sure it was difficult, she did make it sound easy. But I think that was just probably because she's come through that now. She's kind of laid that trail for herself, hasn't she? And it just sounded so exciting and such a unique story as well, I think, to have created a career where she's able to work in two different countries. I mean, wow. I thought that was just so exciting. But yeah, I think she obviously had the confidence as well to say, this is what I want. This is the way I want my career to go. And maybe that's an important message as well. But you don't always know, do you, what opportunities are available? And she did describe those challenges at that postdoctoral stage, didn't she? You know, when you finished your PhD, that's a real challenge. You know, what are your career opportunities? You know, especially if you were a research nurse. But she was able to use her confidence and her skills to influence a really bespoke career, I think. And again, she did highlight the importance of having key people around you that will support you. So, yeah.
But you're right. That sort of my question was, I think, was based around the, whether she went straight into a fellowship or because that's what you're sold, isn't it? That you do your PhD, you apply for a postdoc fellowship. If you can't get that straight away, they might be bridging money, and it doesn't. It's never that straightforward. You know, that might be your aim, but it's never that straightforward. But she was open and honest enough to say, I was put straight back in band six in my old role, and that's what we're trying to, and I think through the NHR funding, that's what we're trying to get rid of now, aren't we? To provide opportunity, because that is often where you fall off the ladder a little bit. It's not pre-doc, it's not doctoral. It's that right, I've got the doctorate, but without further funding, I can no longer further develop this career.
Yeah, and I think that there really is that fear. I know as I'm edging closer to that finish line, I'm thinking, how is this going to work? And how do you do this? And that it may very well be that I end up, I have to go back, well, you know, just continue as a research nurse for a short period of time. But it's a real challenge, I think. She certainly described to us, I think, how she navigated that, but also gained resilience as well. You know, she said at the end, I think she says, you know, there can be some really tough challenges through your PhD and through, you know, your clinical academic career. But you gain more resilience once you've overcome them. So I suppose developing that resilience and that confidence helps you to think, well, actually, once I've got an idea of what opportunities are available to me, I'm just going to go for it. But yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? But so helpful, I think, to hear her describe her journey and where she's got to.
And the starting point was different for me. I mean, I'm listening in, I'm listening when I interview people whilst also waiting to speak, because you want to intervene at times and you want to ask things. And I no longer have preset questions. I'm pretty much where I know what I want to ask now based on the previous interviews. But I often listen back prior to us doing the summary and think, I should have asked that, should have asked this. But obviously, you've got the time span of a podcast and you want to let people talk. But I wish I'd asked her about the training a little bit, because that sort of sports medicine that she described and rehabilitation, it just shouted out physiotherapy. I just thought, I wonder why you didn't go into physiotherapy. And but she moved on then. So I ended up really homing in on the research nurse role. But I do wonder why she didn't become a physiotherapist with that background. And I think, you know, we should be very thankful that she became a nurse, because she's got a very broad skill set.
Yeah, that's right. And she said, you know, the area she really wants to work in is heart failure, didn't she? So she's really kind of carved it the way she wants it. But yeah, really, diverse set of skills, I think she's built up, and knowledge, hasn't she? But you know, it just goes to show that, you know, whatever you wherever you start out, you can mold your career the way you want it to be, but you still need the right support, don't you? You need that time as well. She mentioned having that internship to be able to write her application for funding. So it is really important that you get that protected time. But the more you become aware of how to do that, I think it certainly helps. Yeah.
And it's an important story that we need to tell through perhaps part of the clinical academic series or part of a new series further down the line around the research nurse role. But we need to hear more, particularly from those people that have sort of broken that ceiling, I think, and worked through. I was a research nurse in 2004 and enjoyed every aspect of it, and it really added value to my interest in research when I wanted to do a pre-doc and did a master's in research many years ago. It sort of whetted my appetite a little bit. So it's a great road in, and it does bring a skill set that some, you know, some PhD students in the healthcare settings have never done consent, have never considered all
Exactly.
of the things that need that they're going to need to do in their PhD. And never looked at recruitment and retention and follow-up and all the things that I did as a research nurse, and you've no doubt done in your research role. So it is a good grounding. But I think the message for me often when I hear people talk about breaking that ceiling, like yourself and like Rosalind, is that it's the relationships you build, isn't it? It's not the role that people judge you on. It's the relationships you have with them. So if they value what you've done, they trust you in your role, and you excel at what you do, you'll often find somebody that thinks, actually, I could help you to do this, or have you thought about that, or opens new doors for you. So the serendipity that I always moan about, the people talking about luck and being in the right place at the right time, you earn that. It's the relationships that you develop with your colleagues. Sometimes people have spoken about good mentors that have been nurses, and in a lot of cases, people who have had good mentors who've been medics. If you make those relationships,
oh,
they
yeah,
support
for sure. Absolutely. And they can help you to think of things a bit differently as well when people come from different disciplines. You're absolutely right. I think it's crucial, isn't it, to have those relationships and build up those networks. And I guess, for me, this interview with Rosalind as well, she did kind of send the message as well that sometimes you have to be a bit fearless and put yourself out there, don't you? And she did take that risk, didn't she, at that interview?
Yeah.
That really stood out for me when she said, I want to do my PhD.
Yeah.
With that risk of knowing, would that put your potential employer off? Which you'd hope it wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You'd like to
yeah.
think, actually,
yeah.
that your employer would think, wow, this is great. Mm. This person's got ambition. I'm sure that their enthusiasm will be a real benefit to the role.
Yeah.
That they're going to embark on. So yeah, I really enjoyed listening to this.
And I didn't, I was quick to jump on her when she said that, because that was when I intervened at the start of the interview and said to her, actually, I have to stop you there. How do you go about doing that at an interview? You're going for an interview as a research nurse and actually saying, I want to be a nurse researcher before you've even set foot in the door. So all credit to the people that were on that panel that thought, we can work with her in what we want her to do from an employment perspective, but equally there's somebody here that we can build up and support. So all credit to the people that employed her to do that.
Absolutely.
I'd say they were still in the minority, and that's generally because they've got a funded study and they have to prioritize that. Let's not play down what happens here, but there is a sense of that if there are people with the foresight to think, I've got a research nurse here that can really strive forward. There are PI courses now for research nurses. And, there's nothing to hold you back from leading research as a research nurse in a supportive environment.
Of course. And maybe that's something, I think this podcast will help maybe research nurses to realize that there are these opportunities that you can develop, and become a researcher yourself, because you do come with such a unique skill set. Like you say, there'll be PhD students out there who have never collected data. Haven't gone through the governance, haven't got the same level of understanding of the ethics. So you come already prepared with all of that knowledge. So it's a really good setup. I loved as well, the way she describes her two positions that she's in as well now, in her postdoctoral career, and the language barriers that she spoke about of working in an international country. But of course, she's made it work, hasn't she? It sounds like she's making it work. And I love that, because that just opens up a whole new level of opportunities, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You don't just have to work in this country. But of course, she said, I think she said it was a hangover, or did you say it was a hangover from COVID, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
we now have this more flexible approach as well to perhaps being able to have a hybrid role as a researcher, which again brings more opportunities.
And I have to admit, for somebody like me who's been very much a one institution career, I've stayed where I felt I'd built networks. I've built up networks of people that have enabled me to move on in my career. So it fills me with anxiety at the thought of going to here. I'd be thinking, it would always feel like starting again, having to build new relations. But it really filled me with anxiety, the thought of a study meeting in a second language, Norwegian.
Yeah.
It's hard enough when you're in your own study meetings and you've got a statistician and you're going, just explain that again, just simplify that for me. You're thinking somebody's doing that to you in Norwegian.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
That's there's real bravery there to go and do that.
There really is. Hats off to Rosalind, because I think that it is a very brave position, but she's doing it, isn't she? I'd love to know more, actually. So Yeah,
Yeah, yeah.
fantastic to
And
hear from
nice to
her.
get that side of her. I think most people will have come across or heard of her podcast. So it was nice to give her the chance to go the other side of the microphone really and hear a bit more about her and a really fascinating episode. So I think from regards to the summary, we'll leave it there. Just to reiterate a few things, we've got the RCN conference later in the year where a live episode will take place with Professor Joanne Cooper. So if anybody's going to the RCN conference, do look out for us at that fringe event. I'm going to drop a link into the notes for this that there are national podcast awards currently out for advertisement. Now, I don't think we're going to sort of break any hearts of the big boys with it. I know we won't, but it would be lovely to get a notification that we've been nominated. So I will put there's a listener award. So I will put the link in, and all you have to do is type in the name of the podcast and it finds us. And then you press verify and it sends you with your email, and it sends you an email just to say, did you do this vote? If anybody's willing to vote for us, we'd love to say we were nominated for the National Podcast Awards. That would be enough for me.
Yeah,
That
that'd
would
be
be
great,
enough.
wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it would. And we've got some good news this week, haven't we, as well, that we've received this week. This episode will be out on Monday, so it's still quite current to where we are today. That we've been listed as one of the 15 best podcasts for nurses in this week's Nursing Standard. So that
Hey.
was nice. Well, credit to
Yeah,
us both,
brilliant.
and nice to get that recognition that people value it, and that's an independent review of podcasts. So we're really happy with that as well. So if you're willing, again, like I always say, to click subscribe, leave us a message, or in this case, do press on the little link for the podcast awards. We'd really, really appreciate it. Just to get that nomination would be enough for us, I think. So on that note, that brings us to an end for this episode. Thank you again for your time, Eleanor.
Thanks, Andrew.
Lovely. Speak to you soon. Bye bye.
Take care.